Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily in a healthy community on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Here we are, episode number 200. It's Monday, February 27th. I am recording this from an undisclosed location that looks eerily like my den. Okay, well, let's start with a couple follow-up stories as it takes a little bit of time for science to develop. First up from the Associated Press, flu vaccine worked well in season that faded fast, says CDC. Early estimates suggest the flu vaccine performed well in the U.S. winter flu season that has already dissipated. The vaccines were more than 40% effective in preventing adults from getting sick enough with the flu that they had to go to a doctor's office, clinic, or hospital, health officials said during a CDC meeting. Officials generally are pleased that the vaccine is 40 to 60% effective. Annual flu vaccines are recommended for everyone 6 months or older in the U.S. About half of eligible kids and just under half of adults got flu shots in the last several months, according to the CDC. Vaccination rates were up compared with the 2021-2022 season, but below what they were before the COVID-19 pandemic hit in 2020, said the CDC. And the nice thing is they measure effectiveness by having to seek out healthcare, but even if you didn't seek out healthcare, the flu vaccine still can be helpful. It can either prevent you getting infected at all, or it can make a course of disease much less severe. Missing work and that type of thing might be avoided. Okay, next up, also from the CDC, the effect of pre-departure testing on post-arrival COVID infection among international travelers. So the pre-departure testing requirement was associated with a 52% lower post-arrival COVID-19 positivity. So this is international flights. Pre-departure testing can reduce COVID transmission risk during or after travel by reducing the number of infectious travelers. These results can help guide decisions for future outbreaks. So that's pretty impressive. It cuts it more than half just by doing testing before you get on an airplane internationally. Good to know. Okay, well, let's switch gears and go right to some environmental news. This, a groundbreaking study, is reported by The Hill. Forever chemicals disrupt key metabolic processes in children and teens. Exposure to forever chemicals interferes with several critical biological processes, including the metabolism of fats and amino acids in children and young adults, a new groundbreaking study has found. The disruption of these processes can increase susceptibility to a variety of illnesses, such as developmental disorders, cardiovascular disease, cancer, and metabolic diseases like diabetes, according to a study published in the Environmental Health Perspectives. Focusing on this age group is particularly important to the authors, as children and young adults go through key stages of development that may make them more vulnerable to toxic exposures. This stage in life is also the period in which many serious diseases that manifest in adults begin to take root. The compounds in question, known as per- and polyfluoroalkyl substances, PFAS, are already linked to illnesses such as thyroid disease, testicular cancer, and kidney cancer. Notorious for their ability to persist in the human body, water, and soil, these synthetic compounds have become ubiquitous in both the environment and in everyday products. We found that exposure to a combination of PFAS not only disrupted lipid and amino acid metabolism, but also altered thyroid hormone function, lead author Jesse Goodrich of the University of Southern California School of Medicine said. An additional important finding flagged by the authors was the fact that the exposure to a mixture of PFAS rather than to a single type fueled the disruption of these biological processes, I'll just make an editorial note, and I've reported on this before. One of the weak links in our toxicological testing is we test single substances. And this is a good example. In this study, when you looked trying to associate a single PFAS substance, and there's many, 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 although like five or six main ones, there actually wasn't a correlation. But when you look at the mixture, the total combination, it can create very serious problems. So if you're doing toxicological testing, you might say, oh, this doesn't have an effect when you look at it individually. But when you look at the actual exposure, is a whole host. Another story. Almost all Americans, they warned, had detectable levels of several types of PFAS, which can be found in common household items like waterproof apparel and food packaging, of all things. Okay, next up from ProPublica, this, quote, climate-friendly fuel comes with an astronomical cancer risk. The EPA recently gave a Chevron refinery the green light to create fuel from discarded plastics as part of a, quote, climate-friendly initiative to boost alternatives to petroleum. But according to agency records obtained by ProPublica and The Guardian, the production of one of the fuels could emit air pollution that is so toxic, one out of four people exposed to it over a lifetime could get cancer. That kind of risk is obscene, said Linda Birnbaum, former head of the National Institute of Environmental Health Services. You can't let that get out. That risk is 250,000 times greater than the level usually considered acceptable by the EPA division that approves new chemicals. Chevron hasn't started making this jet fuel yet, the EPA said. When the company does, the cancer burden will disproportionately fall on people who have low incomes and are black because of the population, because that's the population that lives within 3 miles of the refinery in Pascagoula, Mississippi. Yep, so Mississippi takes it again. ProPublica and The Guardian asked Maria Doa, a scientist who worked at the EPA for 30 years, to review the document laying out the risk. Doa, who once ran the division that managed the risk posed by chemicals, was so alarmed by the cancer threat that she initially assumed it was a typographical error. EPA should not allow these risks in Pascagoula or anywhere, said Doa, who now is the senior director of chemical policy at the Environmental Defense Fund. In January 2022, the EPA announced the initiative to streamline the approval of petroleum alternatives in what the press release called, quote, part of the Biden-Harris administration's actions to confront the climate crisis. While the program cleared new fuels made from plants, it also signed off on fuels made from plastics, even though they themselves are petroleum-based and contribute to the release of planet-warming greenhouse gases. Aside from the chemical that carries a 25% lifetime risk of cancer from smokestack emissions, another of the Chevron fuels ushered in through the program is expected to cause 1.2 cancers in 10,000 people with a lifetime exposure, also far higher than the agency allows for the general population. The EPA division that screens new chemicals typically limits cancer risk from a single air pollutant to one case of cancer in 1 million people. The agency also calculated that air pollution from one of the fuels is expected to cause over 7 cancers in every 1,000 workers, more than 70 times the level EPA's new chemicals division usually considers acceptable for workers. In addition to the chemicals released through the creation of fuels from plastics, the people living near the Chevron refinery are exposed to an array of other cancer-causing pollutants, as ProPublica reported in 2021. In that series, which mapped excess cancer risks from lifetime exposure to air pollution across the U.S., the highest chance was one cancer in 53 people in Port Arthur, Texas. The 1 in 4 lifetime cancer risk from breathing the emissions from the Chevron jet fuel is higher even than the lifetime risk of lung cancer for current smokers. So like everybody living around that that refinery or processing facility, whatever you call it, is basically increasing their risk of lung cancer more than if they were all smoking. Yikes. We asked Scott Throw, an air pollution specialist who worked at the EPA for 30 years, how existing regulations could protect people in this instance. Now an independent environmental consultant, Throw said the existing testing and monitoring requirements for refineries couldn't capture the pollution from these new plastic-based fuels because the rules were written before these chemicals even existed. There is a chance that equipment designed to limit the release of other pollutants may incidentally capture some of the emissions from the new fuels, he said, but there's no way to know whether that is happening. In her 3 decades at the EPA, Doa has never seen a chemical with that high a cancer risk that the agency allowed to be released into a community without restrictions. The only requirement seems to be just to use the chemical as fuel and have the workers wear gloves, she said. Yikes. While companies have made fuels from discarded plastics before, this EPA program gives them the same administrative break that renewable fuels receive, a dedicated EPA team that combines the usual six regulatory assessments into a single report. The irony is that Congress created the Renewable Fuel Standard Program, which this initiative was meant to support, to reduce greenhouse gas emissions and boost the production of renewable fuels. Truly renewable energy sources can be regenerated in a short period of time, such as plants or algae. While there is significant debate about whether ethanol, which is made from corn, and other plant-based renewable fuels are actually really better for the environment than fossil fuels, there is no question that plastics are not renewable and that their production and conversion into fuel releases climate-harming pollution. Okay, well, let's switch gears a bit and look at a very important social determinant of health, that is food security. This from Kaiser Health News. Looming cuts to emergency SNAP benefits threaten food security in rural America. Officials estimate families will see a 30 to 40% decrease in SNAP payments as emergency allotments tied to the public health emergency halt in 32 states. We have so many households who simply aren't going to know that this is happening. They're going to go to the grocery store and expect to have money in their account and not be able to buy food they need to feed their families. And as the fallout from these cuts hits, food pantry managers in rural areas find themselves on the front lines trying to fill gaps in their communities. They and policy food experts fear it won't be enough. For every dollar worth of groceries a food bank distributes to a community, SNAP delivers $9. So, yikes. So, only about one-tenth of food security dollars assistance is actually coming from food banks. There's just no comparing the scale of SNAP to the charitable food sector. It's simply not possible to make up that difference. Each household's benefits will drop by at least $95 per month, with some households absorbing as much as a $250 reduction, according to the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. There's no way that I see that we're going to make up fully for what's being lost, said Ellen Vollinger, SNAP director of the Food Research and Action Center, an anti-hunger nonprofit in Washington, D.C. The cuts will reduce payments to households that receive assistance to an average of about $6 a day, adding that $2 per meal isn't enough to feed a person, especially given other factors, like rising fuel, rent, and grocery prices. Some older adults, she said, will see the most precipitous drop in benefits, going from $280 a month to $23 a month. The study published by the Urban Institute estimated that the SNAP emergency allotments helped more than 4 million people stay above the poverty line in late 2021. Non-Hispanic, Black, and Hispanic people saw the biggest reduction in poverty levels, according to the study. In Montana, the expanded SNAP benefits were cut in the summer of 2021. Brent Weisgram, Vice President and Chief Operating Officer of the Montana Food Bank Network, said that reporting from the network's partners shows a 24% increase in the number of households seeking assistance from emergency food pantries from July 2021 to July 2022, the year after the cuts. Food pantries are not prepared to absorb the impact of the cut to the largest federal nutrition assistance program and are strictly a supplemental resource. Food banks nationwide are still coping with increased demand that began in 2020. That lingering need from the pandemic, coupled with food price inflation, leaves food pantries less prepared for demand resulting from cuts to SNAP emergency allotments. In 2009, SNAP recipients received on average about 15 to 20% more in benefits as the federal government responded to the challenges of the Great Recession. A family of four received $80 more a month in benefits. In 2013, the government rolled the boosted benefits back, averaging a 7% cut for households. The effects were immediate and long-term, including significant spikes in food insecurity and poverty-related hunger that lasted for nearly a decade. The cuts this time around are much greater than in 2013, and there's much less time for states to prepare, making it more difficult to ensure SNAP recipients are aware of the benefits they're about to lose. And being unaware of benefit cuts is nothing unusual. This one regarding Medicare, this from Fierce Healthcare. Majority in survey not aware of Medicaid redeterminations. A recent survey of adults found that more than 60% are not aware their eligibility for Medicaid could be in danger, underscoring the massive task states and managed care plans face ahead of an April 1st deadline. The analysis published by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation looked at the awareness of the looming Medicaid eligibility redeterminations at the end of 2022. The survey, conducted by the think tank Urban Institute, showed awareness was lacking across the country regardless of the area. It found that 16% of adults were only a little aware of the eligibility redeterminations, 14% were somewhat aware, and 5% were very aware. Next up, also have some Medicaid stories, and these two are about Medicaid waivers, which are specific things that states can request to modify their Medicaid program. So, you know, each state's Medicaid program is a little different based on these waivers, which isn't necessarily a problem, but it really does highlight the fact that there is a big difference in Medicaid from state to state, and that that having a national program might shore up the benefits of different programs. But here's two waivers that might be helpful. First, from Associated Press, U.S. plans to allow Medicaid for drug treatment in prisons. The federal government is planning to allow states to use Medicaid funds to provide drugs to combat addiction and other medical services for people at state jails and prisons in an effort to help some of those most at risk of dying in the nation's overdose epidemic. Dr. Rahul Gupta, director of the White House Office of National Drug Control Policy, announced that states would be encouraged to submit proposals for how to use money from the joint federal-state low-income health insurance program for incarcerated people. Those that do would be required to provide mental health and drug treatment and would have the option to add some other services. Advocates have long called for such a move, and the government last month announced that California was being given approval to use Medicaid for some services for incarcerated people. The Medicaid plan presents a departure for the joint federal-state health insurance program for low-income people. When it was launched in 1965, it came with a ban on using the funds to help incarcerated people. Because, of course, incarcerated people aren't really people who need health care. Studies have found that the majority of people incarcerated in jails and state prisons met the criteria for drug dependence or abuse, and that former inmates are far more likely to die in their first weeks after release than the average non-incarcerated person. The leading cause of death for people newly released is overdose, partly because tolerance to drugs decreases for people who don't use them while incarcerated. Advocates for allowing Medicaid to fund treatment in lockups say it could keep people alive and reduce crime. And in a similar Medicaid waiver study, this one's a little more expanded to all prisoners. This from Stat News. Medicaid during incarceration, a step toward health equity. Help for millions of people across the country may be on the horizon in the form of a Section 115 waiver to Medicaid's inmate exclusion policy. The waiver allows Medicaid to be activated for eligible youth and adults in jails and prisons up to 90 days before they are released. California is the first state to receive this type of approval from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, but a dozen other states have waiver applications in the works. Activating Medicaid for an individual before leaving incarceration is a first and critical step towards reducing systematic barriers that create gaps in care between the carceral and community health systems and exacerbate health inequalities. Each year in the U.S., about 650,000 people are released from prison and 9 million return to their communities from jail, often with multiple chronic conditions, few medical records or medications, and no insurance or continuum of care. As a result, they face a risk of death in the 2 weeks after release that is 12 times higher than that of the general population. The risk for overdose death is a staggering 120 times higher than the general population. Okay, well, next up, let's turn to some global news. This from Stat News. United Nations says progress on reducing global maternal mortality has stalled since 2015. The progress the world has made in reducing maternal mortality has stalled in recent years, with some regions, including Europe and Northern America, backsliding since 2015, according to a new report from the United Nations agencies. The report estimated there were 287,000 maternal deaths globally in 2020, a slight decrease compared to an estimated 309,000 maternal deaths in 2016. The rate of 223 maternal deaths per 100,000 live births in 2020 meant that, on average, someone died from a pregnancy or childbirth-related issue every 2 minutes. Officials stressed that most of these deaths are preventable or treatable with access to quality care. The stagnation means the globe is falling increasingly behind the UN's 2030 goal of lowering maternal deaths to 70 per 100,000 live births, World Health Organization officials said as they released the report. More than 1 million additional maternal deaths will occur by 2030 if the current trends continue. The deaths are a wake-up call for all of us to take action to avoid future deaths, says Anshu Banerjee, a WHO Assistant Director General. Overall, the global rate of maternal deaths fell an average of 2.7% every year between 2000 and 2015, before flattening over the last 5 years. But some regions experienced rising maternal mortality rates from 2016 to 2020, with a 17% increase in Europe and Northern America and a 15% increase in Latin America and the Caribbean. WHO officials noted that those regions had comparatively low absolute maternal mortality numbers at baseline. The reason for an individual country's progress or lack thereof are complex and can vary, with factors including a lack of investment in primary and maternal care, as well as shortages of health workers and medical supplies. But broadly, maternal mortality rates reflect whether people have access to competent, respectful care, especially in the 24 hours around birth, when most maternal deaths occur, WHO officials said. Maternal deaths increase when women have less access to quality, timely services, particularly around the time of delivery, said Jenny Cresswell, an epidemiologist at WHO and author of the report. Anything that creates a barrier for that, either for the whole population or for subgroups within a population, can lead to increasing maternal mortality rates. Leading causes of maternal mortality include severe bleeding, high blood pressure, infections, and other health conditions that pregnancy can aggravate, including HIV/AIDS and malaria. Another cause the report cited, complications from unsafe abortions. At a press briefing, WHO officials stressed that women deserve autonomy over their sexual and reproductive health. Nearly half of pregnancies are unplanned, underscoring how an estimated 270 million women lack modern family planning methods. The ability for women to choose if, when, and how many children they will have is a fundamental right, said Lael Say, WHO's unit head for integration in health systems. And next up, a somewhat related story, but focusing on the U.S., more investment in primary care needed, report finds. This from MedPage Today. The federal government is underinvesting in primary care, and the primary care workforce is shrinking, while access to care is declining, according to a report which was commissioned by the Milbank Memorial Fund and the Physicians Foundation. Given declining life expectancy, racial and ethnic health disparities, the current epidemic of mental health needs, the ongoing COVID-19 pandemic, and other nationwide issues that primary care can help address, these findings represent an urgent call to policymakers and other stakeholders, wrote Yalda Jabarpour and co-authors of the American Academy of Family Physicians, which put together the report. It is time to accelerate adoption of policies that will demonstrably increase investment in high-quality primary care, create a robust primary care workforce, and enable analysis and learning around the impact of primary care. The report also found that the percentage of adults reporting that they don't have a usual source of care is increasing, and that too few primary care physicians are being trained in community settings, even though that's where most primary care takes place. In addition, the report noted, there are few federal funding opportunities for primary care research. The report, which used a scorecard to evaluate primary care in the U.S., elaborates on several points. Underinvestment in primary care. From 2010 to 2020, the percentage of total healthcare spending allocated for primary care has been low, and little progress has been made over time, the authors wrote. U.S. primary care spending for all insurance types over the decade varied from 6.2% in 2013 to 4.6% in 2020, while nations in the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, industrialized nations, spent an average of 7.8% of total healthcare expenditures on primary care in 2016. So we do a lot less than European and other nations, developed nations do. Next, a shrinking primary care workforce. From 2012 to 2020, just 20 to 21% of all physicians completing their residency, or 1 in 5, were practicing primary care 2 years later. Overall, about 1 in 3 U.S. practicing physicians are primary care physicians. So the data point to a national need to strengthen the primary care physician pipeline to prevent the shortage from worsening. So the current, we have 1 in 3 are primary care physicians, but we're only getting 1 in 5 out of the pipeline. So that points to trouble. The problem is particularly acute in medically underserved areas. Between 2012 and 2020, the number of primary care physicians in medically underserved areas remained static, but the primary care physician supply in non-medical underserved areas rose, increasing the gap by 5%. And I would note, the report also said that Ohio was one of the worst for new primary care physicians in the pipeline. Adults lacking a source of primary care. Although studies have shown that having a usual source of care can improve patient outcomes, 27% of U.S. adults report no usual source of care or reported that the emergency room was their usual source of care in 2020, up from less than one quarter in 2010. It is notable that this trend occurred in spite of steadily decreasing rates of uninsurance due to Affordable Care Act coverage expansions. The reason could be underinsurance, inadequate physician supply, or changing patient behavior. Regardless of the cause, there appears to be fewer of the long-term clinician-patient relationships considered intrinsic to the definition of high-quality primary care. Okay, next up, some continuing coverage on hospital price transparency. This from Fierce Healthcare. Tighter price transparency enforcement standard requirements for hospitals are on the horizon. The Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services leaders say the agency has handed out nearly 500 warnings to hospitals falling short on price transparency as of January, and plans to streamline enforcement and standardize hospital reporting requirements are in the works. The federal price transparency requirements went into effect January 1, 2021. They require hospitals to post a comprehensive, machine-readable list of their services and prices, as well as a patient-friendly tool to help shop for 300 common services. An analysis conducted in late 2022 among 600 randomly sampled hospitals found 82% consumer-friendly display compliance, 82% machine-readable file compliance, and 70% compliance in both areas. The agency heads noticed that this review came after rulemaking that increased the penalty for noncompliance from over $100,000 annually per hospital to more than $2 million annually per hospital. The Center for Medicaid and Medicare Services estimate is substantially more generous than other recent analyses that use different cutoffs for full compliance. On February 6, patientrightsadvocate.org released its latest semi-annual review that deemed just 24.5% of 2,000 sample hospitals to be fully compliant, up from 5.6% back in July 2021. The watchdog group wrote in its latest analysis that many hospitals that had posted information were still found to be non-compliant due to most hospitals' files being incomplete, illegible, or not having prices clearly associated with both payer and plan. So it depends which standard you're using. It's going up. But if you're using a little more rigorous standard, it looks pretty bad at less than a quarter compliant. Okay, well, hospitals are at the center of gravity of our healthcare system. Why aren't they working? Here's a story from Stat News. Nonprofit hospitals are failing Americans. Their boards may be a reason why. More than half of U.S. hospitals are nonprofit, meaning they receive generous tax exemptions in exchange for benefiting their communities. Many aren't fulfilling that mission. Some nonprofits have billed patients who should have qualified for charity care, racking up billions of dollars in charges. Some have aggressively collected on medical debt through legal action or reports to credit agencies. Others have exploited poor communities by maintaining a token presence there to qualify for federal subsidies that benefit the needy, only to expand to rich communities. At least one institution has explicitly set up care pathways that prioritize the elite at the expense of the general public. The multiple failures of nonprofit hospitals who serve their communities and staff raise key questions around governance. When decisions must be made, who holds leaders accountable for their actions? Who actually sits on hospital boards? The percentage of hospital board members who are staff members has declined in recent years. In an American Hospital Association survey, almost one-third of hospital boards did not have a single physician member, while almost two-thirds lacked even one nurse. In a study published in the Journal of General Internal Medicine, researchers examined the professional backgrounds of the board members of 15 of U.S. News and World Report's 20 highest-ranked hospitals, all nonprofit academic medical centers. These 15 publicly listed the 525 members on their boards. 44% came from financial sectors, representing investment funds, real estate, and other entities. Less than 15% were healthcare workers. About 13% were physicians and about 1% were nurses. These findings are cause for concern. If hospital executives are largely held accountable by finance professionals and corporate leaders instead of by clinicians and patients, might they focus more on revenue and expenses than the needs of their communities or staff? Good question. The lack of frontline employees on nonprofit hospital boards raises questions about whose voices are heard, whose experiences inform decision-making, and above all, who is valued. The near absence of workers other than physicians on boards is particularly notable, given the critical roles and vantage points of nurses, therapists, technicians, and other staff. The composition of boards may contribute to the gap between rhetoric and reality with respect to health equity. In the American Hospital Association's 2018 survey, 42% of U.S. hospitals had only white board members, and 70% of board members were male. Partly because board members tend to be major donors, hospital boards may often reflect broader inequality rather than respond to it. Many nonprofit hospitals spend less on charity care than for-profit hospitals, even though they receive sizable tax breaks for providing community benefits. Prioritizing charitable care to low-income neighborhoods, often communities of color, may lead to financial losses, a tension between purpose and profit that boards help navigate. If boards better reflected the communities their hospitals serve, this tension may be navigated differently. That we couldn't find a list of board members for five of the top 20 hospitals demonstrates a potential lack of transparency, to say the least. Patients, healthcare workers, and community members have few mechanisms to hold nonprofit hospital leaders accountable. They are not elected by the public or chosen by shareholders. Many of these hospitals enjoy such significant market power that patients often cannot take their business elsewhere, as they might do in more competitive markets. And I will add that, as I've reported later, over 90% of healthcare is delivered in highly concentrated markets. Failing to publicly disclose the names of board members via accessible web pages shields hospitals from public scrutiny and erodes accountability. The need to evaluate hospital governance is urgent. For now, healthcare workers can encourage nonprofit hospital leaders to diversify their boards across multiple dimensions, including race, gender, and socioeconomic status, and also to include a broad range of frontline workers. To help this along, organizations such as the American Hospital Association could develop an accreditation process to certify boards that are adequately representative, including various types of healthcare workers and patients that match the demographic characteristics of their communities. If voluntary efforts fail, regulation could be considered. The Internal Revenue Service could mandate standardized public reporting of board composition and require boards to meet certain criteria to maintain their tax-exempt status, which is highly valuable to nonprofit hospitals. Criteria could be borrowed from existing models within and outside healthcare. Among federally qualified health centers, for instance, at least half of board members must be patients. Due to new rules, NASDAQ-listed corporations must annually disclose data about the board's gender and racial characteristics and include two, quote, diverse directors. New criteria could also stipulate how board members are chosen, borrowing from legislative proposals like the Accountable Capitalism Act introduced in Congress by Senator Elizabeth Warren, which requires that 40% of corporate board seats be selected by employees. Together, such measures could help reform hospital boards to protect patients and empower frontline workers. You are listening to Just for the Health of It, WAKT 106.1 FM Toledo, We Act Radio. Just for the Health of It is the People's School of Public Health in the University of Life. Okay, well, hospitals may be at the center of the healthcare system. Hospitals and the healthcare system is not at the center of public health. And we have a good article to get at that. This from Stat News. Fixing U.S. public health will require a health systems revolution and for physicians to take a backseat. A classic warning in public health goes like this. A society that spends so much on healthcare that it cannot or will not spend adequately on other health-enhancing activities may actually be reducing the health of its population. No nation is as guilty of this practice as the United States, with its extremely high health expenditures alongside abysmal population-level health outcomes. But the medical field's corrosion of public health doesn't stop at budgets and policies. Through its stranglehold on resources and institutional power, the U.S. medical profession has also come to distort the very definition of public health and what is now widely believed to constitute relevant knowledge. As I noted in a related essay in The Nation, lessons from labor history, social anthropology, political economy, epidemiology, communication, law, and various other non-medical fields represent the bulk of the expertise that is most essential to formulating effective public health policy. Medical interventions constitute just 10 to 20% of modifiable factors that affect health, yet narrow biomedical expertise has been consistently prioritized in the selection of U.S. public health leaders from local to state and federal levels. The marginalization of non-biomedical knowledge within public health administration and the corresponding elevation of physicians to power has had catastrophic consequences for population-level health. While the clinical frameworks that characterize medical training are appropriate for the one-to-one encounters of patient care, misapplying them to the population-level problems of public health leads to a failure to effectively anticipate and address the social conditions upon which disease and disability feed. This in turn fuels a top-heavy, reactive national public health policy that prioritizes profitable medical treatment rather than the cost and life-saving prevention via community-based social services. Declining life expectancy in the U.S., now at its lowest level in nearly two decades, reflects the consequences of this policy choice. Rebuilding public health in the U.S. will require reclaiming it from its biomedical perversions. In place of physicians who are world-leading experts in narrow doctor think, the country needs public health systems led by collectives with training across the range of social and biological sciences that effective public health policymaking must synthesize. America doesn't need a world-leading virologist in charge of responding to viral threats, for example. It needs people prepared to work collaboratively to integrate virological insights supplied by advisors who are world-leading virologists with the on-the-ground realities of labor, political, economic, psychological, and cultural dynamics in order to produce effective policy. These kinds of collaborations are essential not only for formulating good public health strategies, but also for the equally important task of communicating to politicians and members of the general public how and why public health matters and why building it and what building it requires. As both an ethical and a practical matter, public health systems necessarily prioritize protections for those who are put at greatest risk by the current state of affairs. As shown by the history of global health apartheid during HIV, tuberculosis, and COVID-19 epidemics, with amplifications linked to unmitigated spread among neglected groups, failing to safeguard the health of those put at greatest risk by ongoing inequalities ultimately puts everyone at risk. It's for this reason that the most effective public health systems are designed and implemented from the bottom up. They see the world, quote, from below. That is, from the most marginalized positions in a society where the obstructions to health are most apparent and oppressive. Enabling this kind of approach requires listening to, valuing, and directly involving individuals with lived experience of how and who the existing systems are failing. People who are unhoused, elderly, immunocompromised, migrant agricultural workers, racialized, those identifying as LGBTQ+, those living with histories of incarceration, and otherwise vulnerable groups. To put marginalized on-the-ground knowledge to work, to deepen and reward it, the country must build community-based, community-led care systems that empower individuals and, by extension, their families and neighborhoods via employment with living wages to provide supportive care within their own communities. These kinds of accompaniment-based systems, such as the National Community Health and Justice Worker Corps I recently proposed in the New England Journal of Medicine, are essential for providing the relational infrastructure needed to build trust, shared safety, and health by directly meeting people's everyday needs. They are also indispensable for generating the on-the-ground knowledge upon which functional public health systems depend to be responsive to a population's ever-shifting circumstances and to earn ongoing popular support. Investments in community-led care also have enormous potential to reduce out-of-control U.S. healthcare spending. This could then free up additional resources to use for further supporting communities rather than continuing to see trillions swallowed up by the cost of simply treating the medical consequences of public abandonment. In sum, what U.S. public health needs, even if those who benefit from the status quo refuse to see it, is an inversion of the power structure that governs it. Rather than doctors perpetually running the show, clinical and scientific experts need to acknowledge the limits of their knowledge and embrace supportive roles in a redesigned public health system that is guided by and accountable to the communities whose lives are most affected by public health policy decisions. This doesn't mean the physicians and scientific experts don't have an important role to play, don't have important knowledge to contribute, nor that they should disengage from public health. In fact, they need to do precisely the opposite. Deepen their commitment to public health by organizing for it. Physicians should embrace that through epistemic humility, solidarity, and accompaniment alongside dispossessed communities, not the individualistic cult of leadership that so often permeates elitist education and institutions, that they have the potential to most effectively contribute to building public health. When the current U.S. health systems and wealthy interests it serves are so deeply entrenched, can any of these much-needed shifts come to pass? Change will no doubt require mass political pressure from many sides at once, and reliance on heroic acts or self-sacrificing individuals will not be adequate to take the country where it needs to go. As a nation, Americans must reclaim public health as a collective political project by and for the people, and demand the supportive investments in communities that it requires. While scientific expertise and its supporting proper role is indispensable to our shared safety and health, It can no longer be used as an alibi for refusals to build the public systems for care upon which the country's future depends. Woohoo! Let's make it so. Okay, next up, a couple stories on the limits of healthcare in the U.S. here. This is from Medical Express. More than half of veterans with likely PTSD do not receive treatment. Most people with suspected post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD, do not receive care, according to a study published in the issue Medical Care. The researchers found that the majority of participants had not received any PTSD treatment. 56% of veterans did not, and 86% of non-veterans. So veterans actually are more likely than a general population to get PTSD care, but it's overwhelming majority, 86% of non-veterans who have suspected PTSD do not receive any care. And if you want to move into the public health realm of social determinants, maybe we should try to reduce the violence in our society, both domestically and internationally. Okay, well, here's an interesting story on the end of life. This from Medical Express. Palliative care doesn't improve psychological distress, finds study. Palliative care, a specialized medical care focused on quality of life for people with a serious illness such as cancer or heart failure, isn't likely to reduce psychological distress, according to a Rutgers study. Researchers involved with a study published in the Journal of Pain and Symptom Management found that there were no statistically significant improvements in patient or caregiver anxiety, depression, or psychological distress in a meta-analysis of 38 randomized clinical trials of palliative care interventions. This study took results from 38 previously published studies and combined them to examine the average effect of the interventions on psychological distress. In palliative care, general psychosocial support is often offered, but this approach is less effective than evidence-based therapeutic interventions such as cognitive behavioral therapy. Palliative care interventions vary widely in terms of professional backgrounds of team members and use of evidence-based therapies for psychological distress. So certainly should be using whatever evidence-based interventions we have, but I also wonder, you know, when you're at the end of life and receiving just palliative care when treatment no longer makes any sense, maybe that's just stressful. Okay, and completely changing gears, this from Medical Express. Disordered eating impacts 1 in 5 youth worldwide. More than 1 in 5 youth worldwide report disordered eating, according to a systematic review and meta-analysis published in JAMA Pediatrics. Based on 32 included studies with over 63,000 participants from 16 countries, the researchers found that the overall proportion of children and adolescents with disordered eating was 22%, with girls significantly more likely to report disordered eating at 30% and boys at 17%. With increasing age and body mass index, disordered eating became more common. These high figures are concerning from a public health perspective and highlight the need to implement strategies for preventing eating disorders, the authors write. Identifying the magnitude of disordered eating and its distribution in at-risk populations is crucial for planning and executing actions aimed at preventing, detecting, and dealing with them. So clearly, young people in the world have a diseased view of eating, and this is problematic. Now, I was kind of curious how exactly they're defining this, so I looked up the 5-question questionnaire that they used to assess this, and I'll give you those 5 questions. You can make of it what you will. First question. Do you make yourself sick, that is, induce vomiting, because you feel uncomfortably full? By the way, if you answer 2 of these 5, you're considered to have a disordered eating status. 2, do you worry you have lost control over how much you eat? 3, have you recently lost more than 15 pounds in a 3-month period? 4, do you believe yourself to be fat when others say you are too thin? And 5, would you say that food dominates your life? So if you answer to 2 or more of those, you fall into the same category as 30% of young women and 17% of young boys across the world. Okay, next up, a story on nutrient fortification. This from Medical Express. The U.S. Preventive Services Task Force recommends folic acid to prevent neural tube defects. The U.S. Preventive Services Task Force recommends folic acid supplementation for people planning to or who could become pregnant, and this is a grade A recommendation, meaning the highest level of evidence. Based on the finding, the task force recommends a daily supplement containing 0.4 to 0.8 milligrams of folic acid for all persons planning to or who could become pregnant. Daily folic acid supplementation should be started at least 1 month before anticipated conception and should continue through the first 2 or 3 months of pregnancy in order to achieve benefits. So this is actually on top of some years back, I'm not sure exactly when, but it's been years, that they started fortifying grains with folic acid. because it prevents these neural tube defects, which is a very severe birth defect, which can be life-threatening or disabling. And that reduced these neural tube defects way more than half. It was a rather profound effect. But still, even on top of that, since these defects occur very early in pregnancy, usually before a woman even knows they're pregnant, you really need, that's why they put it in the general food supply. So you didn't have to just say, oh, I'm a woman of childbearing age, so I should take the supplement, which is basically what this is saying. But certainly, if you're planning to get pregnant, you should start supplementation months before you plan to conceive. Okay, well, next up, changing gears as well, kind of an interesting story for some people. This is a thing that people want to drink unpasteurized milk, I guess claiming that it's somehow, you know, more natural, that much better for you. But this is a study published in Epidemiology and Infection, Foodborne Illness Outbreaks Linked to Unpasteurized Milk and Relationship to Changes in State Laws. From 1998 through 2018, 202 outbreaks and 2,645 outbreak-associated illnesses occurred because of drinking raw milk. Areas where raw milk was legally sold had 3.2 times more outbreaks than areas where the sale of raw milk was illegal. Areas where raw milk was allowed to be sold in retail stores had 3.6 times more outbreaks than areas where sale was allowed only on farms. The study shows that laws that increase the availability of raw milk are associated with more illnesses and outbreaks. I wouldn't advise drinking unpasteurized milk. Okay, well, let's end our reporting on some good news. And this is a very interesting interface between something very natural, exercise, and a more pharmaceutical approach to mental health or depression. This from Medical Express. Exercise more effective than medicines to manage mental health, says study. University of South Australia researchers are calling for exercise to be a mainstay approach for managing depression, as a new study shows that physical activity is 1.5 times more effective than counseling or the leading medications. Published in the British Journal of Sports Medicine, the review is the most comprehensive to date, encompassing 97 reviews, over 1,000 trials, and over 128,000 participants. It shows that physical activity is extremely beneficial for improving symptoms of depression, anxiety, and distress. The lead researcher, Dr. Ben Singh, says physical activity must be prioritized to better manage the growing cases of mental health conditions. Physical activity is known to help improve mental health, yet despite the evidence, it has not been widely adopted as a first-choice treatment. Our reviews show that physical activity interventions can significantly reduce symptoms of depression and anxiety in all clinical populations, with some groups showing even greater signs of improvement. Higher intensity exercise had greater improvements for depression and anxiety, while longer durations had smaller effects when compared to short and mid-duration bursts. We also found that all types of physical activity and exercise were beneficial, including aerobic exercises, walking, and resistance training, Pilates, and yoga. Importantly, the research shows it doesn't take much for exercise to make a positive change to your mental health. Senior researcher Professor Carol Mayer says the study is the first to evaluate the effects of all types of physical activity on depression, anxiety, and psychological distress in all adult populations. Examining these studies as a whole is an effective way for clinicians to easily understand the body of evidence that supports physical activity in managing mental health disorders. We hope this review will underscore the need for physical activity, including structured exercise interventions, as a mainstay approach for managing depression and anxiety. Well, I predict if you could put exercise in a pill and you could sell it, it would be much more integrated into our healthcare system. But hey, just one more of the many benefits of exercise for your health. Okay, well, that brings us to the final segment of the show, bonus articles, a carefully curated combination of headlines you can use and long reads for increased enrichment, available online just like all the stories I've reported on in this episode. I'll give you the link at the end of the list. I have 19 bonus articles this week. First up, East Palestine residents could get Medicare for life after Ohio disaster. So this is a really interesting little twist. There is a provision in Medicare and federal law that if you are subject to an environmental disaster, it's possible to actually give everybody who's subject to that environmental disaster Medicare for life. So I'm thinking that maybe we should just declare the entire U.S. as an environmental disaster and just have Medicare for all. That's my solution. Okay, bonus article two, Ohio story. Ohio abortion rights campaign unveils ballot proposal and first official step for possible statewide November vote. So the language has been submitted. Woohoo! Bonus Article 3, U.S. abortion rights groups and law firms launch legal defense network. Well, when you criminalize healthcare, you have to bring some of the lawyers in. It's a very legally precarious situation for both patients and providers. Bonus Article 4, as the pandemic swept America, deaths in prisons rose nearly 50%. So this is much greater than what it was in the general population. I reported a lot of this throughout the pandemic, and sure enough, after the fact, able to count up all the deaths and the rates, and yikes, a 50% death increase in prisons, which were not exactly a particularly safe place to be, particularly that prison populations tend to be younger than the average population. Okay, bonus article 5. Cereal, pasta, and other food companies blast the FDA for being too strict definition of healthy. Well, the fact is, the newly proposed FDA definition for healthy would exclude the vast, vast majority of those foods found in the grocery store. And of course, food marketers want to be able to call their foods healthy. I think they're actually pretty much on mark with what they're doing. Of course, it's hard. There's always going to be some arguments around the edge. But hey, if the food companies are against it, it's probably a good thing. That's the regs. Okay, bonus article 6. From the masters of corporate prevarication, tobacco companies pledge, quote, harm reduction, but are doing the opposite. The continuing story of those that practically invented seeding doubt. And hey, look over here. That's the tobacco companies. And another tobacco story, bonus article number 7, passive vaping. It's time we see it like secondhand smoke and stand up for the right to clean air. So I've done a lot of reporting recently that, you know, the initial hopes were that vaping would not be as dangerous as smoking, but yikes, it looks like they're converging as far as how dangerous they are. And that likely holds for secondhand smoke as well. Bonus article 8. Gun industry could be held liable for shootings under proposed state laws that empower victims of gun violence to have their day in court. So some states are changing the laws that might get around some of the immunity that the federal government has granted the gun manufacturers. In Article 9, going big and environmental, it would take less than 3% of big oil's profits to clean up rising methane emissions. So methane emissions are one of the quickest and fastest greenhouse gases. And it's actually going up. It's not going down. Well, CO2 is going up as well. So we're not making progress in the sense that we're reducing it overall. But with the huge profits, particularly that have been made, 3% would clean up, not just reduce the rise, but clean up methane emissions. We have very good methods for doing this. It's just a matter of we have the technical ability, we just don't have the political or regulatory environment to do it. Bonus Article 10. In 1996, the EPA was ordered to test pesticides for impacts on people's hormones. They still don't. They are being sued again. They've actually been sued a couple times before, and they've gotten some, you know, new deadlines, which they've kind of pushed through. But 1996, come on, that's last millennium. And of course, I did a story on, pesticides, and so I've done a lot of that on there over the years now that it's been. And this is pretty frightening. It's a good example that you can actually have laws and regulations, but if they're administered or actually acted upon, they don't do people any good. Okay, bonus article 11. Needed, a new framework to make sure health companies play fair with patient data. So it's kind of a wild west. It's, the whole free market out there, very little regulation, and people are profiting off people's private patient data. Need some way to get at that. Bonus article 12, there is a worrying amount of fraud in medical research. Again, kind of a Wild West scenario. It's pretty widespread, but it is also concentrated in a small amount of people who are doing an awful lot of fraud. Some people are just lifting entire data sets and just changing the disease and submitting it to journals and such. So yeah, pretty crazy. So if you want to geek out on that, that article is a great one to look at. 13, a new scientific review on masking COVID isn't what you think. Science isn't easy. So this is a new Cochrane review, which is considered kind of the gold standard. And it was very broadly, which is kind of unusual. It's not a good setup. It's a good article if you want to geek out on science. But I would say there's a bias towards randomized clinical trials, which doesn't work well for all interventions. It works better for like drugs, which is kind of what our health system is geared around. But for instance, smoking, there's never been a randomized clinical trial on smoking. So are we supposed to say the evidence is moderate or weak, you know, with smoking? You know, there's never been a randomized clinical trial about, you know, whether jumping out of an airplane with a parachute is bad for you, but anybody with half a brain can figure that one out. So if you want to get into the details of why that's, it's also being touted as kind of an anti-massing when really it isn't so. They had like 78 studies and only two of them even had to do with COVID during the pandemic. Article 14, how might the metaverse impact public health? So if you're into tech, there's some both positive and negative challenges to public health the metaverse might present. 15, a follow-up story to what I've reported on before, small aircraft fuel is still poisoning children. So they're talking about eliminating this because small aircraft can still use leaded fuel. And that may not seem like a huge problem for a lot of people, but if you're living in a community near an airport with small aircraft and you're in the line, whew, you're getting rained upon with lead, which of course is very, very dangerous for children and their development. Bonus article 16, stomach flu or norovirus on the rise, what to know. If you're interested in that, it's a good primer for that. Here's a good broad-based social determinants kind of article. Article 17, most young men are single, most young women are not. So this is a good kind of outlining of those social and demographic changes and how it affects our society and even our health. Article 18, health, not age, is driving a rise in pregnancy complications. So we've seen a steady rise of complications in pregnancy in recent years. And there's also been a steady rise in the age that women are becoming pregnant. But only 2% of it is actually explained by age. Most of it is underlying health is poor going into pregnancy and during pregnancy that are seeing problems. And 19, last but not least, 10 ways to reduce your risk of dementia. Let me run through this really quick. 1, keep an eye on your blood pressure. 2, protect your hearing. 3, support efforts to reduce air pollution. 4, prevent head injury. 5, limit alcohol use and avoid smoking. 6, stay cognitively engaged. 7, follow a heart-healthy diet and maintain regular exercise throughout life. 8, maintain healthy sleep patterns. 9, stay socially engaged. 10, take care of your mental health. You do that and it'll bring you a lot more health benefits than simply helping mitigate dementia. So remember that. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the John Snow Memorial Studio. John Snow is considered the father of epidemiology, the science of public health. He studied infectious waterborne cholera outbreaks in London and famously persuaded local officials in 1854 to remove a pump handle from the infectious well that he had tracked down as the source. The cholera outbreak ended, and emerging germ theory took a quantum leap forward in battling the then leading causes of death, infectious diseases. May his passion and scientific tenaciousness continue to inspire us all today. Here at WAKT, We Act Radio, passion is an essential ingredient to our life. And while scientific assessment is key to public health success, passion is as much a touchstone to success in living well as anything. So, I will close with a quote from the Reverend Dr. Howard Thurman. Don't ask what the world needs. Ask what makes you come alive and go do it. Because what the world needs is people who have come alive. And on that note, let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. Check them out. I need some justice.